Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Judiciary Committee, so we call it to order. I want to thank everyone for being here on a bright Monday morning with a little Oregon sunshine outside in the form of liquid. So we have no possible introduction of committee bills. What we're going to do is go straight into our informational meetings. We do have a couple of bills for consideration after we do the informational hearings, and so we will be doing public hearings and more than likely work sessions if we are in agreement. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our first informational hearing. That's going to be the overview of the Oregon State Police. We have Superintendent Travis Hampton, and Travis, I understand you're going solo.
Yes, sir.
All right. I had Bill down here just a backup, and I guess he's going to be there. Got your backside.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Pozdanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Hampton. I have the honor of serving as the Superintendent of Oregon State Police, and thank you for this opportunity to provide the agency overview this morning. Chair Pozdanski, I have about 14 slides. It should take me about as many minutes to go through, and of course, welcome questions during or after the presentation.
All right, we'll be watching. Thank you.
Thank you. Just quickly, the vision, mission, and values of the Oregon State Police. These were refreshed latter part of last year with employee input and incorporated into the agency five-year plan. The vision of OSP, to provide premier public safety services. The mission, founded in 1931, the mission of the Oregon State Police is to serve the state of Oregon with a diverse workforce dedicated to the protection of people, property, and natural resources. And values, honor, loyalty, dedication, compassion, and integrity. Compassion and integrity were added from an employee pool this last go around. I just want to spend a little bit of time on the department organizational chart. Deputy Superintendent Terry Davey cannot be here today. We had a trooper involved in a serious motor vehicle crash yesterday in Coos Bay, so she's attending to matters on the South Coast. But you already know Captain Bill Fugate in the back of the room. Captain Fugate has been with the agency for many years, and he serves as our public information officer and our legislative liaison. So I just wanted to make sure we all had a face to the name. The state police has six bureaus reporting to the superintendent's office. I'll just read these off left to right briefly so folks are familiar with the services OSP provides beyond our uniform services. The Police Services Bureau, led by Major David Anderson, has our historical administrative oversight of patrol, criminal investigations, fish and wildlife. He also oversees our forensic services, our crime labs, and our state medical examiner's office, Dr. Karin Gunson. Within criminal investigations, we have the state sex offender registration programs and Oregon Athletic Commission, which provides oversight to boxing, wrestling, and mixed martial art events in the state. The next bureau, Major Andy Hyder, leads our agency field operations. This was the bureau I spent the last 25 years in prior to my appointment as superintendent last July. It has our field operations in addition to our special operations teams. These are the fish and wildlife detective patrol troopers that deliver the services, about 600 officers statewide. The next over is Public Safety Services Bureau, led by Major Tom Worthy, has our dispatch centers, our central records, which process about 750 records requests a month. Our CGIS information services, which holds LEDs and ID services, criminal history files. IT technology services, and as of last Tuesday, our school safety tip line that went live, which we are very proud of. Next bureau over, Gaming Employee Services Bureau holds our lottery, led by Major Joel Lujan. Tribal Gaming, our internal affairs, we call professional standards. Our HR department leads our policy efforts, risk management, and training at the academy. Next bureau over, Oregon State Police is proud to have the Oregon State Fire Marshal as part of our organization. Fire Marshal Jim Walker leads these efforts. And on the administrative front of our department, a civilian employee, Colin Kneeling, leads our fiscal, budget, accounting, payroll, facilities, fleet, and procurement. Just another quick snapshot of the department. I think a lot of people identify with the green side. This is our uniform services and our detectives. Just a little bit different view of our agency org chart. The middle, that gray area, are the support administrative functions that support our department. And over in the blue are the sole public safety services the OSP provides. Just a little bit different snapshot of the same chart. One takeaway from this, Mr. Chair, I don't want to make this a ways and means presentation, but OSP does hold significant amount of vacancies in that green section to pay for the other aspects of our department. Next slide.
Superintendent, can you, I know that, I don't want to put you on the spot, but about how many down officers or troopers are we down at
we
this point?
We routinely, depending on the time of the biennium, hold between 20 and 40 trooper vacancies to not only pay for our sworn services, but the professional staff services of our department. OSP is about 1,366 FTE, and about half of those are sworn. The rest are the professional staff that you'd see in the gray and blue bubbles.
All right. So I think that's important for us to keep in mind as we're doing a lot of our work, realizing the stretch that we have on the resources and how limited they are at the state level for being able to provide the adequate service that is, I guess, somewhat on the average of what is deployed in other states.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Law enforcement hot topics that I'll address briefly. These are just not OSP specific, but staffing levels, our equipment, racial profiling, use of force statistics, and budget. As Chair Posnanski just referenced, our staffing level for OSP is depicted on this chart. 1980, OSP was removed from dedicated funding source. And as you can see, as licensed drivers depicted in the green have increased over 50%, the state's population has increased over 50%. Our field force of OSP troopers has decreased over 40%. When you consider the vacancies that we hold to pay for the traditional, non-traditional side of OSP, our staffing vacancies would probably be closer to 50% decline if we talked real people working the road. This is particularly troubling not only for the safety of our employees, the citizens we serve. Oregon is regrettably also in a three-year slide for fatal crashes, double-digit increases over 14, 15, and 2016.
And Superintendent, again, I would just for historical perspective, my understanding is the decision that was made in 79-80 through multiple decision-making processes on the executive and the legislative branch basically pushed the funding that would be for highway patrol work back into the general fund. Taking it out of the dedicated funding that was there and that actually seemed to be working quite well as to that portion of the agency. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chair, that is accurate.
So that's another thing that we need to keep in mind is that once we actually took them out of the dedicated funding and putting them in the general fund, we've seen the decline of the number of troopers that can be available out on the roads.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, yes. Was there historically a dedicated funding source for the troopers, and what was that?
It was the gas tax. Everything was went into the portion that we now use for highway fund for the roads, the bridges, roadways. They were part of that, and then, you know, who's to say why, but it did happen. And once they moved out of there, it put their ability, I mean, basically, instead of having the dedicated funding, they went in against any and every other program that gets general fund money.
Yes, sir.
And when did that change happen?
It was the 79 legislature that I believe that did it, and if I remember correctly, and I think it went in effect in 80?
In 1980, yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
That's correct, Senator Dimbrough. How does Oregon stack up? Nationally, troopers per 1,000, we are second from the bottom nationally. If you would like to look at a comparable state, number 15, Oklahoma, has roughly the same population as Oregon with 3.9 million residents, and they are staffed with 820 troopers compared to Oregon's 330 road-ready troopers. I think you'll hear from Director Gablix a little bit later. If we were to have a chart listing state troopers, sheriff deputies, and police officers in total, we would see a similar chart. We'd be at the bottom or near the bottom per 1,000 residents. Just a little bit of a personalized slide for members to see how their office was staffed in 1980. Looking across the room, as we look at Springfield, Salem, Cave Falls, Portland, you'll see that roughly have half the state troopers in your community. Portland's hit a little bit tougher. This is to deal with the diversity of policing demands that we have today compared to 1980. OSP does not have a 24-hour office in the state other than our other funded contracted position at Oregon State University. The red offices depict offices that we have essentially closed the physical office in that community and reallocated any remaining personnel to the sister or neighboring offices. I do not want anyone in attendance today to walk away with the impression that OSP is still not a very effective field force. And how we do that, we leverage technology and equipment where we don't have the people. This is the map, the same map of our patrol offices with the triangles and the stars, but the little red dots are troopers living in those communities that home garage with their vehicles. OSP embraces the mobile office platform that troopers have enjoy a one-to-one car ratio, our uniformed troopers. They are ready to deploy from their homes 24 hours a day. Many of them do after hours. These troopers are equipped with their, like I mentioned, their own vehicle, their own weapons. They have a mobile data terminal in their car, so they essentially have a dispatch platform. They can type reports. They issue tickets in an e-citation manner from their vehicle. They, for many, many years, OSP's had in-car camera to video the front and passenger compartment of the patrol car. So these troopers are road ready to deploy, whether it's a natural disaster, a standard policing challenge, or like our winter storm, when we had almost every trooper that was able out working. This really removes some inefficiencies on having to return to an office, take your equipment out of a car, next trooper is ready to get going. I can't deploy a Prineville trooper to downtown Portland for civil unrest if that trooper is waiting to share a car back home. So by having that mobile office, we are still a very effective field force. We are not big, we are fast, and we are mobile, very efficient. On the topic,
Senator Manning.
Yes, Superintendent, one question. I think that you may have put it out there earlier. The troop strength, I was looking at the comparison rates and stuff, you know, to other states, and obviously I see some room that we need some improvements in terms of manpower, you know, and other officers. So there have been a couple of incidences happening, you know, that have taken some of our troopers offline, injuries and, you know, and things like that. And I know that it has a negative impact, you know, a devastating impact, you know, because we're looking at a force that is considerably smaller than some of the states that have a lesser population. So what are we, what is the, what manpower, the strength that you currently have with the injuries and other things that have impacted the force? What does that leave you at what level? I know that you're already down, but how is this all impacting you right now?
Sure. Chair Prozonsky, Senator Manning, that is a difficult question to answer without being a little bit emotional about it. As far as a trooper injured, we had a trooper injured in a car crash yesterday. We had a trooper shot multiple times on Christmas Day. As the agency leader, I have an obligation to point out it's deplorable that we have a trooper that has to lay severely injured for many, many minutes because he has no cover, no backup. And that is a major metropolitan area, the most populated area of our state. That situation is aggravated the further east and the further south we go, where these police officers are put into very dangerous situations without cover. So it is demoralizing. It doesn't have to be a dramatic event like a gunfight, but just trying to manage a traffic crash on the Santiam Pass, when you're trying to investigate a crash and close two lanes of a roadway by yourself, it's very dangerous and it is demoralizing. Our patrol division numbers, you look at the hard numbers, the objective numbers, a little bit of a subjective influence there as our police officers are ready to report to work on average about 66% of their scheduled shift. You schedule vacation, sick leave, injury definitely plays a part, court, training, a lot of certifications to maintain as a police officer. So you take our vacancies we hold through the filter of time loss for a myriad of police officers' obligations plus the free time, and you route them through those filters, and you see we are reduced a substantial amount more beyond what our FTE may show. And so if not for our equipment and our technology, and quite frankly, without the partnerships of the chiefs and sheriffs, we cannot deliver the service we do today. We depend on our partners a great deal, and I think they do on us.
So this, you know, based off of what you just described in terms of that, and that means that the trooper strength can be down as much as 60%. At any given time, in addition to slots that you have unfilled, is that
I'm not Chair Posnanski, Senator Manning. I don't want to 60% from our allocated strength. That might be a little bit heavy, but I think 35-40% of what we have allocated, we could just in any given day, those people are not available for because they're in vacancy. You know, considering our positions are filled, I might show a trooper on this map is assigned to Klamath Falls, but that person may be in their first day of training at the academy right now. And so you, when you factor all in, that's a little bit difficult question to answer, but I think that 35 to 40% mark is fairly accurate.
Thank you.
On the topic of racial profiling, OSP, for the better part of 15 years, has collected data from our traffic stops. We have our database now numbers in the millions for the stops. We gather data. We gather initially from a radio clearance code. Now it's required anytime you contact a citizen through a mobile data terminal, you'll enter the reason for the contact, the race, the gender, and the age of the citizen. Here is a quick snapshot of our demographics versus traffic stops for the year of 2016. The blue would reflect the demographics, the respective demographics. The red would be the traffic stop enforcement data for OSP. This has been fairly consistent for the years and years and years that I've been monitoring OSP data. This chart reflects over 211,000 traffic stops for 2016. OSP monitors our data and analyzes it quarterly. We have a full-time analyst dedicated just to pull our data from the state data warehouse. We not only look at our stop data, but our search data, what we're finding, who we're asking to search, who we ticket, who we warn. So I'm very comfortable and confident that OSP is trying to do the right thing when it comes to collection of our data. We understand that the strength of our police department, our agency, is community-based and only as strong as the community support. So we make this data available to anyone that would like to review it. We've been in a partnership with Portland State University, the Law Enforcement Contact Committee, like I said, over 15 years now, analyzing our data from an independent objective source.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is interesting, but I'm wondering, how do you collect the data? Are you asking the individuals that you have contact with, or where is this data coming from?
Yes, Chair Posnanski, Senator Thatcher, this data is officer impression on who they, that's why you'll have that unknown category. We do have a clearance field that if we don't know what a person's race or nationality is, we don't ask, but it'll, a small amount of these do fall into an unknown category. But if the trooper, we're really interested in the trooper's perception of what the person is they're stopping, that's what's reflecting the data now.
Okay, thank you. Just wondering.
Once again, not trying to make this into a ways and means presentation, but a quick snapshot. This has been mentioned earlier that OSP is heavily dependent on general fund. This little pie chart just shows that relationship to federal funds, other funds, and lottery funds for the agency. And that was Governor's Rec. I should have put it out. Governor's recommended budget by division. Once again, you can see that patrol division, they are expensive. We are expensive. They do take the lion's share of our general fund allocation in the governor's recommended budget.
Senator Lefsicum.
Superintendent, seeing this pie chart with dollars in it, have you thought in any way of marrying that with the slide that you have where you showed us the dedicated funding and the drop in person count, people count? It's on page 5 of your presentation. I have a PDF file of what you're presenting. So slide 5.
Okay.
You've got dedicated funding, the red line dropping 41%, et cetera, but that's not dollars. And it would be interesting to see 50% growth in population, 50% growth in driver's license, and a 41% drop in patrol officers compared to dollars in funding. What does the dollar stream look like over time?
Sure. I don't have that available, Chair Posnanski, but I'll try.
I knew that. I'm just suggesting it would be a meaningful picture to paint for us.
It is. And that might be a difficult to to depict year to year by idem to idem when laws are passed, executive orders are passed, and OSP assumes new obligations, what dollars we've had to take to allocate to other parts of the department. But we'll attempt to produce that document for you. I mentioned earlier, like the Oregon State Athletic Commission, that's we are charged with regulating prize fights, boxing. That's a $1 million unfunded liability that my department has. So I hold patrol troopers vacant to pay for that obligation. That's one example. We'll try to produce that document, though, Senator. Just quickly, proposed policy options packages that are approved by governor and the governor's recommended budget. The Criminal Justice Services Division, we're going through package 100, a replacement of our CrimeView, our LEDS databases. That's titled LEDS 2020. Hoping to go live through this incremental project September of 2020. And this policy option package continues to provide incremental funds to pursue this project. In forensics, the governor's recommended budget, POP 108, provides for the additional resources of 4 DNA biology FTE at our ANC crime lab to combat the state's backlog in safe kits. And just briefly, OSP's legislative concepts, patrol, House Bill 2323, this extends exemption of hour limitation to retired troopers working assignments at the revenue, the governor's residence, and judicial, similar to those working in the Capitol here. 2324 is offensive littering amendment to 164805. Senate Bill 76 defines unarmed combat sports. This is within the Oregon State Athletic Commission obligations, amends some language in ORS 463. And Senate Bill 77 and 78 deal with sex offender registration, SORNA compliance. House Bill 2322 relates to some technical changes, some titles in ORS 146, the medical examiner statute. And Chair Brozanski, that's my last slide. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. I would like to just follow up on the comment that you made that I'm not going to say the title correctly, but the Athletic State Oversight Division that looks at prize fighting and all that.
Yes.
Is it exclusively funded from general fund?
No, it is not. Chair Brozanski, it's not exclusively. It's a fee-based system, a gross tax, I believe 6%. Deputy Superintendent Davey is well versed in this, and if those questions came up, she was ready to handle it. But I understand roughly $250,000 a biennium flows into OSP through the actual events. That would fund roughly one FTE. The program takes a minimum of 4 FTE to properly staff and provide the medical reviews and licensees for these events. So we are staffed through a fee-based system about 25% of what it costs, and so we hold the vacancies to pay for the rest.
All right. I appreciate that. I hope that during your Ways and Means presentation, you will take that message to them. And since we have a member of the full Ways and Means here sitting with us, that it just seems to me that if this is it should be fee-based, why are they only paying 25% of the cost? And it just seems to me that there should be more parity in that if we're going to actually continue to do what we're doing, because these are the type of areas it just seems to me that there's profit, I assume, out in those areas, and it seems like they could be paying a better portion of that for the service that they're receiving instead of taking it off the troopers that would be out in the field. That's a personal comment, but hopefully Senator Manning will remind his colleagues when he's down in the Ways and Means process of maybe we could look for some other directions. Other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, if there's no other questions at this point, we're going to go ahead and go to our second overview. This is going to be of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Eric Gallup is here. Eric, why don't you come on up? And thank you for being here today as well.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Skadlicks. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known by its acronym, DPSST. We're going to follow superintendent's lead and go through 16 slides, about a minute each, to give you an overview of what DPSST does. I'm glad to take questions throughout or afterwards. Okay. So our mission is to promote excellence in public safety by delivering quality training and developing and upholding professional standards, and we'll get in the meat of what that means and how we do it. The history for our agency goes back more than 50 years, and the reason we put this slide in here is because people still call us all three names, and two of the three still exist. We will cover what the Board on Police Standards and Training does, we'll talk about the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, and then we'll talk about the department. Over our 56 years in existence, in 1961, we were created as an advisory board on police standards and training, primarily to look at city, county law enforcement standards out of the Kennedy Crime Commission, which identified across the country that really no standards existed for the training of law enforcement officers anywhere in the United States. In a lot of states, our partner agencies are called POST, Peace Officer Standards and Training, but in Oregon, what was created was the Board on Police Standards and Training. If you look over the years, and we're not going to read this line by line, so I don't want to bore you, but you'll see kind of the growth of the agency over time in partnership with the legislature and in partnership with the people that we serve. We started off, as I said, city county police officer training in 1968. Then in 1976, we started providing corrections training for city county corrections officers. In 1978, we added parole and probation to the academy roster. In 1987, criminal fines and assessments was established, CFA. Before this, there was something called the police training account. In the creation, if you will, of CFA, that is what funds DPSST. So the assessments given on traffic tickets, for example, fund law enforcement training in our state. It also funds crime victims assistance. And what's not used by those two organizations goes into the general fund. So we're not a general fund agency. We're an other fund agency. In 1991, we added telecommunicators and emergency medical dispatchers. In 1993, fire training was added, as was the certification of Oregon State Troopers as part of DPSST's direction. In 1995, we added private security providers. In 2004, the construction of the new academy started here in Salem that a lot of you have had a chance to visit. In 2005, the private investigators were added. For those of you in this building for a number of years, there used to be a group called the Oregon Board of Investigators, or OBI. OBI could no longer stand financially, so they were given to us to pick up, and that's a fee-for-service program that we manage. In 2006, we moved to the new facility. In 2013, through House Bill 3194, we created the Center for Policing Excellence at DPSST, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. In 2015, HIDA was added to DPSST as a fiduciary. They pay their own expenses for us. We basically manage the money for the HIDA initiatives in the state of Oregon and also in parts of Idaho. And then in 2015, through legislative action, OLCC enforcement was added as one of the tenants of DPSST. So if you look at how we operate, we call it public safety shared stewardship. DPSST and our board are asked to regulate the industry for 41,000 public safety and private safety providers in the state of Oregon. So we use a system very much like the legislature, which is through statute we have established five specific policy committees that represents each of the industries that we serve. So we have a fire policy committee, police, corrections, telecommunications, and private security, much like a subcommittee of ways and means would be. And then the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, which is BPSST, made up of 24 members, most of which are confirmed by the Senate, are the larger group, much like the e-board would be. So they're the ones that make the decisions, and we'll talk about what that looks like. And then aside of the board is the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board. So six of those members meet the legislative intent to provide benefits to police officers, firefighters, corrections officers, either killed in a line of duty or permanently and totally disabled in a line of duty. So that's a fund that we administer that the legislature created, and we're honored to do that. And then the last slide is DPSST. That's where we fit in, which is to carry out the work of the board. And then we also administer the Polygraph Advisory Committee, which licenses polygraph examiners in the state, a very small group, less than 100, but we're charged to license them. And then we also staff the Governor's Medal of Honor Commission that's established by statute. So I talked about shared... Sorry.
Sorry, you're on a roll. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay.
Okay, so looking at the last slide, you mentioned the five committee policy committees, and I guess I'm real curious, the policies that you come up with, are they just internal policies, or is it a combination of suggested rulemaking that needs to be done, suggested ORS changes that need to occur, or is it just internal policy for those particular professions?
Senator Przanski's Senator Thatcher, let me go to the next slide, which is a perfect transition. So the board functions are established in Oregon Revised Statute. And what that means is that the board sets the standards for training. So it's not something that I decide as a director of what we should train police officers. The board plays a role in that. They have to, by statute, approve the curriculum that we develop. Deliver. They also set the standards for employment. They deal with revocation denial issues. So when there's officer misconduct, the board and the policy committees are one that sees that. So let's use an example of a police officer that makes a very bad decision that causes their certification being questioned. It would start with the police policy committee. That group would vet that case so they get the full presentation from our staff. They would make a recommendation. Does the conduct rise to the level where that officer should be decertified or not? And either way, their recommendation goes to the full board for consideration. So that case is seen by a second set of eyes, which is the larger public safety board. So the police reps are on there, but the board is the one that looks at that whole case, and they're the ones that decide then do we move forward or not. And then our staff basically facilitates the process. We're not the ones that decide if an officer should be decertified. The board sets that up, and that's done through administrative rule. And they're the ones that see the body of work, if you will. The same is true also for the standards that we use for certification, for training, for licensure. The board of policy committees create those, and then staff carries those out. The policies that I set as the department director deal with how we run the agency. So it's not the administrative rule process. That's all done through statute. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they also help with strategic planning, and they're really the way we represent 41,000 constituents, because if you think about it, it's a way that we can parse out the work but have the different disciplines involved look at their different area. We kind of call it jokingly the United Nations of Public Safety, but it's the way each of those countries, if you will, all the different disciplines have their needs met, and they all really ratchet up to the board and externally through the way we communicate with the different groups we work. For what we do as a department, we staff the board and policy committees. We've got a great staff that comes to work every day to make sure we're doing the right things. We carry out the board's direction. We work with the board's advisory committees. We ensure compliance with BPSST standards. So tying back to your question, Senator Thatcher, the board sets the standard, but the department carries it out. So if an officer isn't maintaining their certification training, their CEUs, then the department administers that process for them, and then we bring it back to the board. The same is true if an officer is not scheduled for the academy. The department will work with that agency to make sure the board standards are being met. And when it's not, it goes to the board for consideration and for review. So there's a very healthy discussion back and forth with the board. The policy committees meet at least on a quarterly basis. The board meets at least on a quarterly basis. So it's a pretty busy, pretty docket that they have going on. And then we also operate the academy. We provide training, obviously, on a state and regional basis. And then we also bring issues forward to the board and policy committee. So if the industry sees an issue, if our staff sees an issue, we'll bring that forward to the policy committees and board to say, this is going on. We want to see if you think we should do something with this. And if so, usually that results in administrative rule being introduced. So we talk about standards for who. And I'll slice it up in four buckets, but we'll deal more with the criminal justice bucket, obviously, because of the Judiciary Committee, and you get involved in a lot of these issues with us. The criminal justice family is city, county, state, tribal officers. As some of you know, we passed Senate Bill 412, which gives tribal police officers the same authority statewide as any other officer. We administer that program within the criminal justice family. So that family includes police, corrections, parole and probation, 911, and OLCC enforcement. So we kind of call that the criminal justice side of our shop. Then we do have fire certification. That's a voluntary certification. There's more than 13,000 firefighters in our state, of which 80% are volunteer. But more than 90% of the firefighters participate in our voluntary certification system. But it's much different than what we see for criminal justice. We also license private security and private investigator providers. it's a lot different what we do there, but we're making sure that people that do those jobs have had a criminal background check. We also make sure they've been trained, that they're licensed. We charge a fee for that service, for licensure, but we're not the training academy for private investigators or private security providers. That's done by their companies or by other vehicles. And then, as I mentioned, a small group of people that we have are the polygraph examiners, the people that administer those polygraph checks.
Yes, Chair, thank you. For the private security companies, you know, listening to what you just said about, you know, overseeing licensing for private investigators, is there any oversight that we use, or are they up to their own, said, okay, well, we'll kind of make our rules just as long as we just stay within the guidelines as we know it? So is there something that, you know, you're looking at?
So, Chair Przanski, Senator Manning, a great question, and really what we're doing are two things. In essence, through the Private Security Licensing Act, we're regulating the industry. So if a company was going to come in and provide security in an event, the state standard requires that all those people are state licensed, so that they've gone through a background check, that they've been licensed. And then we do have a number of compliance investigators that go out and spot check them. And what that does is if there's Company A and Company B, and Company B gets a better rate, if those people aren't certified, that's probably why, or licensed. So we're going to basically check them. So our investigators check bars, they check events. So for example, football venues where they hire private companies to come in, the Newport Wine and Seafood Festival, we'll spot check them to make sure all the people working are licensed, so that they're meeting that good housekeeping seal of approval, that those people don't have a criminal background check, that they're licensed and that they're trained. And if they're not, then we have the ability to cite them. So we're basically regulating the industry. But having said that, the training varies by agency to agency. So we have, you know, mom and pop operations that are small, that provide security services maybe to a lumber mill in a community, and maybe one other business, all the way to some very large companies that protect the critical infrastructure like Bonneville Power, where they could be armed and doing a lot more extensive work than somebody being a night watchman in a security facility at a lumber mill. So we don't really get into that level of local training, but we want to make sure that people coming into the system are meeting that same benchmark. And not only do we cite when we see issues, you know, obviously citation is not what we're about. We're about education. So we want people to comply because they may not know the law. But when we have flagrant violations, that we'll deal with those and cite as necessary. But the other thing is that we're constantly working to educate people, because this is really one of our largest constituent bases. When this industry came to us in the 80s, they thought there might be 5,000 private security providers in the state. Post 9/11, we have more than 10,000, if not 15,000, private security licensees in the state, doing things in a lot of cases the police officers used to be doing. In some communities, larger cities, they're responding to alarms before officers do, to see if there's a break-in, and then they'll call police. So it's a very interesting group, but it's a very busy group.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I ask if there is some kind of standard that all of these private security companies have to adhere by, because if each one, the moms and pops, and then we have the corporate levels, if they have their own specific guidelines or training, it may not be the same or be compliant to our expectations in terms of law enforcement, which could put law enforcement you know, in jeopardy or in question sometimes, because of perhaps the uniforms that they wear, or the type of car that they drive, the markings and things like that.
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, you have hit on a very important issue that we have struggled with, and that we've actually had the legislature help us with, and that is that we do set the minimum basic training course for a private security provider. That's an 8-hour course, or at this point, a 2-day class. It's more than 8 hours now, but that's a basic class that everybody gets. What that officer does at their local facility will grow based on what that company wants them to do. So we don't regulate the entire cradle to grave of the private security training, but they do all get the same base. The issue that you share that raises us concerns is what do they look like and what do they call themselves and what do they drive? We've been involved in a situation in Central Oregon with the community college there where this issue has been actively discussed in the newspaper, and we've been very clear. While they may look like a law enforcement officer, and while they wear a badge and drive a car that says public safety officer, they're not a police officer. They're licensed by DPSST as a private security provider, and that's what they are. So there is no in the middle. You're either a private security provider or you're a police officer. Those are the two standards. And the industry actually gets along well. So law enforcement has a very good relationship with private security. But there are cases where we have people that maybe push that limit. Last legislative session, this body gave us the authority to stop telling companies that come in the future that you can't call yourself something that you're not. So you can't be the FBI, you can't be the CIA. You can't use a name that might perceive that you're a police department. So we can't do anything about the companies in existence, but we do have the ability to regulate that now for new companies. But we did not go all the way to what other states have done with uniforms. So, you know, they could look like a police officer. They wear a badge. They can have a car with graphics that looks like a police department. They can't have a blue lights. So DMV is very clear on that. But we just don't have the authority to go to that level. But what you're bringing up, we get a lot of calls about.
I'm really concerned about that, because other states, women have been assaulted under the guise of they think that they're being stopped by a law enforcement, a real police officer, and find out that the person is not. And then you also have people that wannabes that's not connected at all that go ahead and put in on these vehicles. So I'm really interested to find out more about, this is concerning to me for a number of reasons.
Yeah. Chair Przanski, Senator Manning, we'd be glad to visit with you in person and walk you through what the industry does and tell you where the gaps are, because there are some gaps. I mean, we do a good job with regulating the industry. So when an officer is arrested, we get a LEDS hit. We'll do a suspension on them. But it doesn't stop the issue of if you look like a cop, people might think you're a cop, and we understand that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Senator DeBrow.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, actually. The first one I'll ask just was provoked by this line of questioning. As you said, some of the private investigators are armed. And are there standards for showing competency, with the firearm that you oversee? Or set standards or oversee at all?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dembrow, we do require additional training for an armed officer. There is a weakness in our current construct that is coming in front of you to be addressed to fix that competency issue.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. My other question was about 911. I know we're having issues in Portland over inability to fill positions and to maintain personnel, and there are questions about response time, et cetera. So how does your agency deal with that?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dembrow, the 911 industry for the group within this criminal justice family probably has the most turnover within our family structure, if you will. 80% of that workforce is female, which is somewhat surprising. But what studies have shown is that people that have really good multitasking abilities are in a lot of cases females. So that's a good demographic that we have in that industry. But what we also realize is that we're having those people do very stressful work where they, in a lot of cases, are dealing with the person in crisis or in being a victim of a crime, where those people don't get closure because they send a responder to that and they never know how it ends. So we have obviously the staffing issues, we have mandatory overtime issues. It's the same challenges we have with other public safety disciplines with millennials, where it's a 24/7, 365 operation where you can't pick and choose when you want to work. But the stress levels is very high, and it's been compared to air traffic controllers because of the work that they do. We have a lot of ongoing work with that industry. We provide a very solid training program, but the attrition numbers are concerning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a follow-up. And so does Do you monitor the response times and or take complaints? Do they come to you, or do they stay with the local agency? Do you have some kind of role there?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dembro, our limits are really in the licensure certification. We're not a policy procedure efficiency operation. So if a complaint would come to us, we would send it to the agency because that's not something we're equipped to do, nor would we be able to benchmark that. But if it's a complaint against the person doing the job that's licensed by us, then we would look at that matter.
So, and then just following up, well, Senator Manning, one of the areas that we've looked at, and I know this is a touchy area for agencies, but when a car is decommissioned, a police car, at this point there's no obligation for it to actually be decommissioned from what I would consider where you don't have the side lights, the front grille, and stuff like that. So a lot of, unfortunately, wannabes or someone that may have bad intent has access to that type of vehicle. And it does, in fact, give that unfortunate perception that someone thinks that they're actually being pulled over by a law enforcement officer when, unfortunately, they're not. Senator Lethicombe.
Just to add to that conversation, I would suggest that criminal intent or whatever isn't happening from these individuals that are getting licensure from this organization for private investigator and whatnot. Those men and women, those 13,000 to 15,000 individuals that are coming from licensure are all meeting the grade and doing a good job and aren't the individuals that are, you know, usurping authority by putting on a false uniform or driving a rig that looks like a police car, et cetera. So I think the licensure effort that you're putting at the front door is a great place to put it.
So continuing, let's focus just on standards for criminal justice for this discussion. Employment certification standards for DPSs T3, your action are cradle to grave. So even once a law enforcement officer retires, they're still eligible underneath our system to have their certification revoked. So if they decide to retire, go rob a bank, we'll decertify them. And we also enter into a national database that shows officers that have been decertified. That's something that if you watch the newspapers lately, there's been discussion about rogue cops. They leave one state where they're decertified, they go to another. We're very active in that discussion, and Oregon is used as one of the benchmarks for how we do it well. So we're very proud of that, and that's the relationship we have not only with the chiefs and sheriffs and with labor, but also with the legislative body. We've tried to plug up all those gaps to make sure that bad officers don't get hired somewhere else. The training standards we talked about, there's also a maintenance of certification, so those are continuing education units officers need. Revocation denial, I've handed out to you our ethics bulletin. I've given you a light version and a heavy version. We do that on a monthly basis as an education tool to show the type of conduct that will get officers in trouble. So you'll see the big ones constantly that we deal with are drugs, sex, and money. I'm also very cognizant of the fact that while we do publish ethics bulletin and less than 100 officers a year are decertified, that is a fraction of the number of people out there doing the job. So we have really good men and women doing the work, but the system does hold those accountable that stray from what is the norm, and the ethics bulletin is done to do that. It's not meant to embarrass, so you'll see there's no names of individuals, there's no names of agencies. It's an education tool so people can use it as roll call to say these are the kind of things that people are doing that are bad decisions that end their career. And then the other thing that we're charged by statute with under the criminal justice family is to determine when a person's eligible to run for the office of sheriff. So some years are busier than others, depending on local elections. But when a person applies to want to be the sheriff, then DPS says he has to look at their file and give the county clerk their permission to put that name on the ballot. So that's one of the things that we do on an annual basis. So moving forward into the training element, this is the other big obviously thing that we do. Criminal justice training, 16 weeks, a new hired officer comes to the academy here in Salem. For police, 6 weeks for city, county corrections, 4 weeks for parole and probation, an additional week if you're armed. Not every parole and probation officer in the state of Oregon is armed. It depends on the agency, depends on the assignment. The 911 operators spend 3 weeks with us, and then OLCC spends 4 weeks with us. One of the things that I will just benchmark on this slide is that's time time with us, that's not time before they're ready to go. So once they graduate from the academy and walk across the stage, that doesn't mean that they're ready to go work in the street. What it means is that they finish the academy training, then they go back to their local employer and complete their field training manual and their field training process, which could take up to 18 months, depending on the size of the community. And that is required as part of their certification. So academy and then field training are required before they can be state licensed to be a police officer. And then we also provide fire service training. Most of that is off campus because the bulk of that is for volunteer firefighters. And then we do have the small element of private security training that we talked about. But very different than what we do for criminal justice, where everybody comes to Salem for their basic training.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I assume that these are all fee-based programs?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dembro, I didn't want to make this a Ways and Means presentation, but this is criminal justice and fire are not fee-based. So I'll start with the easy one. Fire is funded by the fire insurance premium tax. So we have a dozen trainers funded through that tax to provide training free of charge to firefighters, both career and volunteer. And then criminal justice training is a partnership between the employer and DPSST, funded by criminal fines and assessment. When a new city, county, state, tribal police officer comes to the academy, we do not charge them for the training. That training is funded by criminal fines and assessments. The salary and benefits of that employee is funded by the agency that's sending them. So, for example, a superintendent's discussion about new troopers, they come to us for 16 weeks. They're blended in with city, county, tribal officers, and then after that, they complete their training with the Oregon State Police, but OSP doesn't pay while they're with us. The expense for a 16-week basic police class for us is over $600,000. So that provides meals, lodging, training, ammunition, vehicle use, all the things that we provide as the training academy. Way back, just going into the superintendent slides, way back, DPST used to reimburse the cities for their salary and benefits when they sent officers, but that funding's not there anymore. So we actually did cover total package for them to be trained, but that's not available anymore. Center for Policing Excellence, something that a number of you were involved in, which was created by 3194, Criminal Justice Reinvestment, created the center at DPSST. We embrace evidence-based policing, and what we really do is look at that and look at how we train the training we provide for basic officers coming into the academy, as well as command staff. So there's an 80-hour supervision class, an 80-hour middle management class. We also offer a 160-hour leadership development program, International Public Safety Leadership and Ethics Institute. We also do research, and I share this because most of the research out there available on a national level is for communities 100,000 and larger, which is great for the four Oregon cities, but it doesn't really help Amity, Oregon with two police officers. How do they take that information and use it? And we do have a lot of communities across the state that are less than five officers, and many more that are less than 10. And those are what we have across the state. Much like the superintendent, we have a lot of places where there's gaps in service across the state. We also do have mental health crisis intervention training. That was a budget add last session. We have a great partnership with the health authority dealing with de-escalation. How do we get officers, public safety responders to engage with people in crisis? Spending a lot of time on police legitimacy and transparency. And again, the goal of this is not only provide ongoing training and advanced training, but also taking what we're learning and putting it at the basic level so we're training new officers these techniques as they come on board. And then we also are moving from death by PowerPoint, and I feel like I'm doing that to you this morning, so I apologize, to facilitated learning. So this is something that you will probably find interesting and maybe also a little scary, but this is the number of academy basic training classes and students that we've been providing. But what we're looking at right now, and this ties into the superintendent's discussion, in 2016, when we did a survey in January, agencies said that they were looking to fill 500 vacancies last year. All of those vacancies have been filled. I know there's been a lot of discussions in the news about do people really want to work in law enforcement? It's tough to find people. But agencies are doubling down their efforts, and they're doing a great job recruiting, and they're finding people to hire. Nobody said let's lower the standards. Other states have said that. We haven't had that discussion here. Agencies are finding people to hire, and they have to come to the academy to be trained. So we're in the process of doing that. A small e-board request, so I'll make the pitch here. We did ask in December to get additional funds to finish up this biennium because the number of people that we're seeing retiring and hiring is through the roof. So we have a request actually right now pending for three additional police classes and one corrections classes just between now and June to fill the number of people that are slotted to come to the academy. So that's working its way through the building. But what worries us even more is in 17-18, the number of people eligible to retire that are certified police officers is more than 1,000. So that's roughly 1/20 of the workforce in our certified law enforcement industry is ready to retire. So as there's discussions about PERS, a lot of these retirees get worried and they could pull the pin at any minute. But right now our data shows that 1,000 are at the place where they could retire if they wanted to or if they needed to. So it's a great news, bad news. Great news is you got opportunities for new people coming in. The bad news is you're losing seasoned employees that know the communities that have been trained, and we've spent tens of thousands of dollars on to educate, train them, and maintain them. But that's one of the issues that we're looking on into the future.
And Mr. Chair, so this just applies to public sector agencies, right?
Correct. So Chair Prozanski, Senator Dembro, so that growth for us or that projection number for DPSST looks at the number of parole and probation officers, 911 operators, city, county corrections, and law enforcement as a whole that are eligible to retire and that would have to come to basic. So we don't look at the private sector at all in that. But that's public employees that are certified in public safety. So our funding sources, I'm sorry.
Just, it's interesting, that's projected training that also probably mirrors very closely projected retirements, right? It's the same, plus growth with population and community size and whatever. So this is a real math problem that the state of Oregon is going to face. It's a demographic shift that we've never seen before.
And I would just say, Chair Prozanski, Senator Lithingham, the discussions we've had with our partners, both in public-private sector, the silver tsunami, as people are calling it, with people, baby boomers, eligible to retire, you're right, this is going to affect every industry. But for law enforcement, which is what our kind of lane is this is what we're looking at for the people that are potentially coming to be trained. So funding sources, really quick, this is how everything is funded. I think I've kind of walked through that. Criminal fines and assessments is a criminal justice mission. Fire insurance premium tax. Private security is fee-based and civil penalties. Our administrative functions, criminal fines. Debt service, which pays for the academy, is the general fund money we get. And then HIDA, obviously, is a pass-through federal fund that we manage for them. Academy physical plant, really quick. A number of you have been out, and I know a number of you are coming out in the next few weeks. We're located right here in Salem, 235 acres, 16 buildings, 350,000 square feet of building space. Very unique with what we do because we really have moved to scenario-based learning. So the new campus has everything that we need to take students from the classroom and into live venues during the day while they're with us. And that's the way they're really learning and applying what they know. And the success has been pretty good for what we're doing. I also always include the Honoring Our Fallen. A lot of you have, and I left you a flyer for this year's Law Enforcement Memorial come out. We're honored to host the locations for both state memorials that honor fallen firefighters and fallen law enforcement officers. The Fallen Law Enforcement Officer Memorial has 183 names of men and women that have died in the line of duty, and this year, sadly, we'll be adding the name of Sergeant Jason Gooding, who died last year in Seaside. And then the Fallen Firefighter Memorial honors 168 firefighters, career volunteer that have died in the line of duty, and those are prominently located right at the beginning of the campus as you come on site. And that's, Mr. Chair, ends us for the presentation.
Well, thank you for the presentation, the efficiency. Any other questions for the director? Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we have two bills for public hearing, and I will be getting the sheets up of who's going to be wanting to testify, but we'll go ahead and open up the first public hearing on Senate Bill 39. And Whitney, if you'll give us an overview, please.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 39, which was brought to us by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Under current law, the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training is tasked with establishing standards for issuing, denying, renewing, and revoking licenses for executive managers and supervisory managers of private security professionals. Senate Bill 39 broadens the Board's authorities in two ways. First, it includes establishing standards for all private security providers' certificates and licenses. And second, it provides authority for establishing standards for the suspension of those licenses. Senate Bill 39 also expands DPSST's, the DPSST is currently also tasked with establishing procedures for issuing, denying, renewing, and revoking a private security provider's certificate or license, and Senate Bill 39 expands this authority to include establishing procedures for the suspension of the license or certificate. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Lindsay Hill. And Lindsay, I understand you're going to give us testimony not only in 39, but we'll keep you up here for 40 as well.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I'm the Professional Standards Division Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, as you just heard, more commonly known as DPSST. This Senate Bill 39, comes to before you on behalf of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training and was developed in consultation with the Private Security Policy Committee as well as the Armed Subcommittee, who reports to that body. As you may be aware, DPSST is responsible for training and certifying Oregon's providers of private security services to include those who provide armed private security services. To become certified as an armed private security provider, an individual must complete the 24-hour basic firearms course, which includes a safe gun handling test as well as a marksmanship qualification. Armed private security certification, once issued, is good for a period of 2 years. After the first year, a certified armed private security provider is required to complete refresher training, which includes the recompletion of the safe gun handling test and the marksmanship qualification. To date, there are just under 1,900 armed private security providers in Oregon. On average, 32% of those don't complete their annual training in a timely manner. DPSST can and does initiate proceedings to revoke the armed certification of those who don't complete their training. However, while the revocation proceedings, which can be lengthy, are underway, the individual remains certified and can continue to carry or have access to firearms while they're providing private security services. The board is requesting the authority to take immediate action in these situations by suspending the armed private security certification until the training requirements are completed. This is a very quick overview, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right, questions from anyone?
Just real quick. Senator Thatcher. Clarification, was that 19 providers, like agencies around the state? Did I hear that number correctly?
1,900 armed private security.
Thank you very much. That makes a big difference.
We certify folks on an individual level, so there's 1,900 people who are certified to provide armed security services.
Senator Dimbrough.
Yes, thanks. So if one doesn't have this certification, can one be an armed security agent and an employee for a private company?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dimbrough, no. The law requires that someone, in order to provide armed private security services, and what that means by definition is someone who's carrying a firearm while they're providing the services, or someone who has access to a firearm while they're providing services, they're required by law to be certified.
So if I could follow up. So if they have, let's say they have a concealed weapons permit, mm-hmm. That's not good enough for them if they're performing their job duties as a private security agent.
That's correct, sir.
All right, before Senator Manning, let me just follow up on that. Just for clarification, this is an individual that's part of a company that's out for hire as compared to if you had a construction company who hired an employee who was a security person for them, they would not be under that same requirement, or would they?
Chair Przanski, they would be. We base our regulation on the definition of what private security services are. So we really look at what the person is expected to do. And in your example, if the person were expected to perform private security services, that regulation would kick in and they would be required to be trained and certified.
All right, and then just a follow-up. You said marksmanship. Is there proficiency?
Yes. Right now, the current marksmanship test is the equivalent to what our state's correctional officers have to qualify on.
Okay, thank you. I think, Senator Manning, did you have a question?
Chair, just to kind of follow up on that, the situation that I got in my mind is that, we're going back to maybe a construction site. Where there's an employee, for example, that's let's say that you're the security, but the person has a concealed carry permit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get real down in the weeds with this because this, that's okay. I'll talk about it later.
Okay.
The language in 39, a private security provider's apostrophe S belonging to that private security provider, that's at the individual level, correct? That's not a corporate or company level provider certificate or licensure. It's actually a qualifier on the individual who's carrying a firearm.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. If no other question, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Lindsay, just stay where you're at, please. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 39. And Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 39 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 39 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Dimbro, I think you're up next on the carry list, if you'd be so kind.
Yes, sir.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 39, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 40. Lindsay?
Thank you, Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Lindsay Hale. I'm the Professional Standards Division Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Senate Bill 40 also comes to you at the request of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. This legislative concept was developed as a housekeeping concept meant to clarify DPSST's fingerprint authorities. I believe it still does that. However, a few other housekeeping items have been added along the way, including the Dash 1 amendments, which I'll speak to at the end. I think that those of you who have had to deal with fingerprinting issues, fingerprinting legislation over the years, can appreciate that sometimes they're a little complex. I will try to keep this testimony as brief as possible out of respect for your time, while still clearly explaining what we're trying to do here. The first issue addressed by Senate Bill 40 deals with DPSST's fingerprint authorities for the various public and private safety disciplines that we represent. As many of you know, all regulatory agencies, DPSST included, need specific statutory authority to request fingerprints for those who want to be certified or licensed by us in order to run a state and national fingerprint check. And the reason we do that is to make sure that those people that we are certifying and licensing meet all of the requirements that are criminal background requirements for state law and for rules. So as for a bit of background, and Director Gablich's touched on this a bit, our public safety constituents, which include all of our criminal justice constituents and our fire constituents, are issued a certification that does not expire. So once they're certified, they are held to the same certification standards throughout their life, essentially, even if they leave employment as a public safety professional. Our private disciplines, our occupational licenses, which includes private security, private investigators, and polygraph examiners, are issued licenses that are temporary in nature. So they'll expire either 1 or 2 years after the individual is certified or licensed and they're required to renew at that time. So the first issue deals with the idea of retaining fingerprints. The Oregon State Police needs specific statutory authority in order to retain a fingerprint for an individual when that fingerprint has been submitted for criminal background check purposes. And what that does is alert the regulatory body if that individual is arrested or comes in contact with law enforcement for criminal purposes in the future. So under current statute, and I believe these statutes were put into place in 2005, DPSST is granted the retain authority for our private security, private investigator, and our polygraph disciplines. because these certifications are temporary in nature, what has happened as a result of that is that there are countless fingerprints that are being retained at OSP on individuals who are no longer within DPSST's jurisdiction. And DPSST is continuing to get notified of criminal activity of these individuals when in reality we shouldn't be. When this issue was recognized about a year ago, there were approximately 80,000 people who were flagged, for lack of a better term. And we've been working very closely with OSP to correct this error. But what we're asking for in Senate Bill 40 is to have the retain authority removed from our private, or I'm sorry, our temporary private licensures and certifications. On the other hand, given the permanency of our public safety certifications, what we would ask for in Senate Bill 40 is to have the retain authority added to our public safety certifications, and this would allow DPSST to receive information on criminal activity by those constituents who are still certified by DPSST and will remain certified by DPSST even after that individual leaves employment. The second issue with Senate Bill 40 is truly a housekeeping. It deals with the application of private security providers. Currently, it's specifically references only certifications, but we also have a licensure program. So by expanding that to include licensures, we're just encompassing all. The third issue was noticed as this legislative concept was being developed to address the retain issue, and it has to do with House Bill 3330, which passed in 2013. This bill requires that electronic fingerprint capture be used exclusively to submit fingerprints to Oregon State Police for regulatory purposes. The bill carved out a few agencies, specifically criminal justice agencies, from that requirement. Criminal justice agencies who have direct access to the FBI's National Crime Information Center, or NCIC. While DPSST by law is a criminal justice agency, we don't have access to the NCIC program. So while we were intended to be exempted, and that intention was verified by discussion with the Department of Administrative Services and our legal counsel as well as theirs, because we don't have access to NCIC, DPSST was not exempted from that requirement. So Senate Bill 40 would expressly add DPSST to that list of agencies that are exempted from electronic capture submission. And the final issue deals with the Dash 1 amendments that were prepared. This was another issue that was recognized very recently, and it deals with ORS 181A.670. What this statute does is require that public or private safety agencies who employ public safety officers give access to DPSST to their personnel records should there be an occasion to review personnel actions having to do with professional standards and the ability of those individuals to retain certification. It was recently discovered that public or private safety agency, the definition in the statute does not include agencies that provide correctional services or parole and probation services. So while we were requesting this information, the liability that was afforded to the agencies who granted us access to that information was not truly being delivered. So what we're asking for with the Dash 1 amendments is simply to clarify that any employer of a public safety officer would grant that information to us and also be afforded the immunity from civil liability that would come with it. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Questions on any of those 4 points? Lindsay, thank you very much. You did very well. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I should have asked. I didn't do it the last time. I just assumed no one else was coming in to testify on DPSST bills. But just for protocol, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 40? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 40. And I would hope that we're comfortable with the Dash 1s. And if we are, Senator Thatcher, if you can make that motion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated February 2nd, 2017.
Senator Thatcher moves that we adopt the amendments to the Dash 1s to Senate Bill 40 with the date of February 2nd, 2017. Any discussion on the motion for the amendment? Not seeing any, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 40 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves Senate Bill 40 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion. Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Thatcher, will you be our carrier?
Sure.
And Senator Thatcher will be our carrier. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 40. And I believe that takes care of our work for today. We will be back here tomorrow at 8:30. And please be aware, I think Thursday we're probably going to start at 8 o'clock because we think we need a little extra time because of the number of presentations and presenters. So not tomorrow and Wednesday, I believe it will still be 8:30, but remember we will start at 8 o'clock on Thursday. With that, we're adjourned.